Right. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. After a short recess, the panel has reconstituted itself with a substitute judge, and we are now ready for the second oral argument of the day. The case is number A20-0747, Hansen versus State of Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. I believe both attorneys know our procedures very well. If you maintain the right view, such as gallery view or another, you will be able to see the time clock at all times. And with that, counsel for appellant, you may identify yourself and begin.
Thank you. May it please the court and counsel, my name is Marshall Tanick. I represent the appellant, Lori Hansen. Lori was for many years the Northeast Regional Director of the Department of Natural Resources. She was a good employee and in good standing with the organization at the time she was terminated in September of 2017. That occurred a few weeks after an incident that she maintains was a whistleblowing incident that led to her termination. It occurred on August 15th, 2017, while she was attending a work-related business conference at the Fortune Bay Casino, that's on tribal property near Lake Vermilion. She was there with her disabled husband. He was her guest there, but she was attending this business conference. They were staying in a hotel at the facility, and they were there for a couple of days. During those 2 days, she and her husband, who was with her, heard next door in the hotel a baby incessantly crying off and on for approximately 2 days. She was very
Mr. Tanick, I think where the court is familiar with the facts. Let me move forward to the analysis. It seems that a significant issue in this case is perhaps making a distinction between her reports, either to her employer or to a government agency on the one hand, and on the other hand, other conduct of hers that may have occurred in the same around the same time in the same place as her reports. I think that it seems that the respondent is drawing a distinction between those two things. It seems that you are not. Isn't it appropriate for us to focus separately and differently on her reports as opposed to her other conduct that is not technically protected activity?
Sure. Well, I don't know if they're different. I mean, they're all part of the same incident that happened that evening, but you're right, Your Honor. I mean, our position is that because of her reporting, and she is covered under the whistleblower statute we maintain, she made good faith reports of actual or suspected illegal behavior, and there is adverse action taken against her. We maintain that the reason for that adverse action was because of her whistleblowing reporting. And the state obviously doesn't. The state points to other things in her conduct that evening. The state seemed to lean heavily on the fact that she was a surveillance camera for approximately 10 seconds showed her without any clothes on while she was in the hallway. She had just come back from a hot tub and she was checking on this noise next door and a couple of what was going on next door. She stepped into the hallway for a very short span. No one saw her, but she was later detected on the surveillance camera not having any clothes on. The state references that 25 times in its brief. So the state's position, Your Honor, correct, you're right, is that her other conduct was the precipitating factor for her termination. So there's obviously two different versions of what happened here, and that's why we maintain that there's a summary judgment was inappropriate, because there's a factual issue as to whether her whistleblowing activity was a causal reason for her termination or whether it wasn't. And I don't think you can necessarily separate the two. I think the proper analysis is to say this is a case where one party has one position, the other party has another, and that's why we have jury trials to determine the facts in this case.
So let me hypothetically, if she had made one phone call, if she had called 911 and said, I'm in a hotel, the people next door to me, I suspect criminal activity there, please check it out. And then that's all she did. So, I mean, do you think that her employer would have terminated her for that phone call by itself?
Well, I don't know what the employer would have done, Your Honor. I can't say. But in this case, all I can do is go with the facts of what happened here. She made multiple calls to just about every law enforcement person she could think of. She called 911. She called the St. Louis County Sheriff. She also called her employer, reported this to her assistant, Master of Health. And she also called the chief law enforcement officer for the DNR. So she made multiple reports here. But I think the real catalyst for why she was terminated, at least in the record, is that the department was upset that she had created, and she had raised some issues about what was going on at the tribe. She also complained about how she had been treated by a tribal police officer who arrived on the scene later. And as the state says in its brief, the DNR says in its brief twice, on pages 14 and 23, Your Honor, both on two occasions, the state says that her superiors, the commissioner and the assistant commissioner who made the decision, were upset at her because she was disrupting relations between the DNR and the tribe. That's a classic situation of a whistleblower protection, Your Honor. The state even admits that the reason it took that action, in part at least, was because the DNR was concerned, that Ms. Hansen's reporting and raising these concerns, especially about what was going on at the casino and with the tribal police, made the DNR look bad and impaired its relationship with the tribe. So that suggests, Your Honor, that there was a causal connection.
But Mr. Tanik, so I want to make sure I understand your argument. Does the fact that an employee makes a good faith report, which I think there's some record evidence, I think the deputy commissioner says this was a good faith reason, the concerns about child welfare and a possible prostitution operation, that those are a good faith basis to make a report. But do you suggest that the fact that there might have been an initial good faith basis to make a report then would excuse kind of dubious conduct that happened after the initial report here, i.e. her apparent unwillingness to accept the authority of the responding law enforcement officers?
No, Your Honor, it doesn't immunize her. The fact that she made a call, as Judge Johnson said, or the fact she made multiple calls, as you indicated, certainly doesn't immunize her. If she had gone out and done something extremely heinous, she couldn't claim that because she made a whistleblowing report, that in and of itself closed her with absolute whistleblower protection. It's a balancing test, and I think the critical issue here is a factual issue. What was the causation for the department's termination of her? And we maintain, Your Honor, that that's a fact dispute. And ultimately, a fact finder has to make that determination. Was her termination because she reported the whistleblowing incident, or was it because of this other conduct, which you referred to as dubious? I don't know if I accept that description, but I get the point, Your Honor. In other words, was the department's termination based upon her whistleblowing, or was it based on other factors, or was it a combination of those factors? In which case, that raises the substantial motivating causation test, which comes up in a lot of whistleblowing cases. It's pretty much the case, I think, in almost all of the whistleblowing and other retaliation cases, that the employee maintains that they engage in protected activity, in this case under the whistleblower statute, in some cases it's under the Department of the Human Rights Act. There's also a mandatory minor maltreatment claim here, but the claimant usually points to taking some protected conduct. The employer responds by saying, no, we didn't act on that protected conduct. Obviously, if they did, the case would be over, but they don't admit it. The employer takes the position that they acted on some other reason, and that puts into dispute what the real reason was here. It creates a fact issue as to causation.
You've made reference to a fact issue a couple of times, and I want to jump to the third McDonnell Douglas factor. And I do that precisely because I realize the first factor, the prima facie basis, a much lower basis. But after you get past the second, which is the explanation by the DNR for the termination, the burden is on your client to present what those facts are to make that causal connection. What in the record specifically did the judge miss that you would point to us that, notwithstanding the conduct of the reporting, that would suggest there are facts to support a causal connection such that the matter should proceed to trial?
No, thank you. Well, and we're not maintaining that there is an absolute causal connection that necessitates summary judgment on our part. We're saying that the facts could be viewed as differing, obviously, and the proper standard is whether Ms. Hansen's whistleblowing activity constitute a substantial motivating factor. It doesn't have to be the only factor. It can be a mixture of factors. And we maintain it was a substantial motivating factor. At least we maintain that a fact finder could make that determination. With respect
to your correct, am I correct, though, that the only fact that was presented is the temporal, the timing issue?
No, Your Honor. That's certainly one of them, and that's a factor. We reckon an inference can be drawn from the temporal factor alone. A temporal factor can be an inference, but we recognize that oftentimes the case law says inference plus, and you ask the question of what other facts are in the record here that would give rise to that conclusion. We maintain, Your Honor, and the record reflect that the department decision makers, the assistant commissioner and the commissioner, they were the two decision makers, indicated that the reason they took the action was because they thought Ms. Hansen's conduct or behavior or her reporting, it's a little bit unclear, but all of everything that happened that night created a disruptive relationship with the tribe. Basically, they're saying what you did caused us to have poor relationship with the tribe, or could cause some poor deteriorating relationship with the tribe. That happens in whistleblowing. Essentially, they're saying she was a troublemaker. Her reporting constituted an impediment on the DNR's relationship with the tribe.
Was it her report of a violation of law that had that effect, or was it other things? For example, I mean, are you saying that she made a report to somebody that the tribe was violating the law? I understand the report to be that the neighboring occupants of the neighboring hotel room were violating the law.
No, but her report was that there was trouble, that there was violations occurring on tribal property, and she also raised reports about she thought she was being mistreated by the tribal authorities when they came and responded to her call. So she said there were violations of law going on at the casino, and when she called for help, her rights were violated because the tribe, essentially the tribal police who showed up there were kind of rough on her. They treated her as a perpetrator. So she made those two complaints.
But what was she saying that the tribe acted in violation of law in the tribe's interactions with her or the BIA agent?
Well, she raised those concerns as being contrary to law, but she doesn't have a whistleblower claim doesn't have to maintain that the tribe violated the law. What she was saying is there were violations of law going on, and the department, according to the testimony of both the assistant commissioner and the commissioner, and in the department's briefs at page 14 and 23, say that the reason that they terminated her was that her reporting constituted an impediment to having good relationship with the tribe.
I don't think that page 14 says that her report did that. I think it talks that there's other, I'm looking at page 14 right now.
Yeah.
It refers to her unprofessional conduct, namely, and then it lists a number of things. And then it says that her unprofessional conduct impaired her ability to professionally represent the DNR and so on.
Right. Yeah, they're saying that she was a troublemaker and therefore she was not in good standing with the tribe, and that would affect the DNR negatively.
Reading that statement literally, it says that it was not her report that had those consequences, but it was other conduct peripheral to her report. And I guess the question, it seems, if we get to the third step of the McDonnell-Douglas test, I think the question is, do you have evidence that would tend to show that that statement of a non-discriminatory reason or a non-retaliatory reason, do you have evidence that that's false?
Well, the evidence is what they said. They said in their depositions that it was because of their concern about relationship with the tribe. And I think both page 14 and 23 certainly imply that. And at a minimum, Your Honor, I think what that raises is a fact issue. A finder of fact has to listen to the evidence and determine what was the real causation. The department obviously is going to say that. I understand that. The question, though, is, are they right or not? Is that the real reason or not? That creates a fact issue that ultimately a jury has to determine. It's a causation issue. There are multiple factors here involved, the department's position, Ms. Hansen's position, and it raises a classic fact issue.
What evidence would the jury rely upon to find that that's not that statement by the defendant is false, not true?
Its statement that the action was motivated by its concern, the department's concern about the interaction that it had with the tribe and how Ms. Hansen's behavior and reporting affected that. Furthermore, there's a separate claim, apart from the whistleblower claim, if I may add this, under the Mandatory Minor Abuse Act, there's a presumption, a factual presumption, that any reporting, if an adverse action is taken after a report is made, is presumed to be based upon the report as a presumption under the Mandatory Reporting Act. And that presumption creates a fact issue under the Southview versus Topi case. In Southview versus Topi, this court considered a retaliation claim under that statute. And because the adverse action was taken within 90 days of the report, there was a factual presumption that precluded summary judgment. So we maintain there's a fact issue here, both under the whistleblower statute and under the Mandatory Reporting Act, that require a jury to make that determination.
I believe Judge Bjorkman may have had a question.
I'll save it for rebuttal.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Tanik. You will have an opportunity for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, you may identify yourself and begin.
Good morning, Your Honors. Juliana Passy on behalf of the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. This case involves a high-ranking DNR official who was captured on surveillance footage nude in a public space of a hotel, behaved unprofessionally when interacting with responding law enforcement, including by referring to her high-level connections, as well as refusing to leave the hotel when asked to do so, and who subsequently lied about her actions during the DNR's investigation. Appellant's unsupported theory of the case is that her report that individuals completely unaffiliated with the DNR may have been engaging in illegal conduct at the hotel caused the DNR to enter a political appointment. She has presented no evidence in support of such a fantastical motive, and this court should affirm, specifically as to the whistleblower claim, because there's no causal connection and there's no showing of pretext. And as to the maltreatment claim, appellant is not a mandated reporter and the DNR is entitled to sovereign immunity.
Ms. Bass, before you go forward, I mean, I also was struck, as counsel for appellant noted at the conclusion of his argument, the number of times that the DNR in its brief refers to Ms. Hansen's brief nudity in the hall. And I mean, I guess perhaps that's unusual behavior, but what is it about 10 seconds, standing for 10 seconds in an unoccupied hallway while nude? Why is that so significant to the DNR's position in this case?
It's certainly one factor, Your Honor, not the only factor, of course, but its significance. First of all, we don't know that it was an unoccupied hallway. We didn't get that in the record. All we have is the video. Ms. Hansen denied during the deposition that that was her in the hallway, but later admitted on summary judgment. So I wasn't able to ask that question of whether or not it was an unoccupied hallway. Regardless, this is a DNR director level employee who is the DNR's representative in the Northeastern region of the United of the state, where she was representing the DNR on both in an international conference with Canadian water individuals. This is someone who needs to be professional at all times, and it's both the fact that she was outside the hallway for a period of time, but also that she lied about it in the investigation when she was specifically asked. This was a concern that was raised directly to the DNR by the tribal law enforcement officer who reported the incident to the DNR as something that he thought showed unprofessional and eccentric, erratic behavior.
I have a question about the causal connection, the third part of the prima facie case. I mean, at that stage of the analysis, isn't it true that we're looking only at the plaintiff's evidence, not at the defendant's evidence?
We are looking at the evidence in the light most favorable to the plaintiff.
And so, and given the fact that there was an investigation started 2 days after the incident, and the fact that she was terminated because of the investigation, I mean, by itself, if we're looking only at that without yet looking at the employer's non-discriminatory reason, isn't that enough at the prima facie stage for the plaintiff to establish the third part of the prima facie case?
It is not, Your Honor, for a number of reasons. First of all, there's a requirement of a showing of retaliatory motive under the case law we cite in our brief. Retaliatory motive is often not at issue because the normal whistleblower case usually involves, someone's, you know, my boss is, you know, skimming money off of the company, something like that. Here, there was no showing of retaliatory motive because she blew the whistle, if on anyone, she blew it on the people in the room next door, not on the DNR, not even on the tribe. She's blowing the whistle on people completely unaffiliated with the DNR.
Let me stop you. I mean, is retaliatory motive part of the prima facie case?
It is part of the analysis of whether there's a causal connection.
And what's the authority for that?
Well, we look at Coakley. Coakley versus City of Otsego is a case from this court from 2001, when it's talking about retaliatory motive is difficult to prove by direct evidence. An employee may demonstrate causal connection by circumstantial evidence that justifies an inference of a retaliatory motive. So that Coakley provides that, and that's also supported by a number of cases, federal cases that are very similar to this in the facts. So Freeman and Pellant are two cases cited in my brief. They're both District of Minnesota cases where the court was looking at this question of causal connection, and they specifically pulled out, you know, in those cases they held that the conduct by that employee was insufficient to provide any kind of causal connection because the thing that they reported wasn't something that would cause them to have problems with their employer. So the Pellant case, they reported that subordinate employees were stealing from the company. The court held it's hard to imagine why a company would want to fire someone for that reason. That was hardly the kind of conduct that would put the plaintiff in the crosshairs of corporate executives. That's precisely what we have here. This is not something where she's reporting child abuse or crime allegedly occurred by the DNR commissioner or anyone with the DNR, anyone even, you know, any connections of the DNR. She's reporting alleged crime of someone that the DNR doesn't even know about.
Ms. Passy, can I just want to, you referenced the Freeman case, and a part of what was criticism by the appellant of the judge's order, and I'm looking in the court's memo where on page 12, I believe it was, it's referring to, like Freeman and Pellant, this court finds it inconceivable and unimaginable that the commissioner or anyone at the DNR would seek to terminate the employee for reporting crimes. I guess my question is, would you agree that that statement itself doesn't help us? It is perhaps not appropriate for a district court, because the question isn't whether the court finds it conceivable if you look at the evidence most favorable to the plaintiff. It's simply whether the evidence supports the claim or not.
Well, there certainly has to be some showing of some motive, regardless of whether or not. The course of the question is a reasonable juror. Could a reasonable juror come to the conclusion that plaintiff is pointing for? There is no evidence here. Perhaps the district court may have overstated a little bit, but the analysis remains the same. There has to be a showing of retaliatory motive. There has to be some showing of connection between the two. No reasonable juror here on the evidence presented by appellants could find that the DNR had any reason to care that appellant raised a question about child abuse. Rather, the clear evidence from the record, and I would, to the extent that appellant is suggesting otherwise, the deputy commissioner and the commissioner's deposition testimony and their declarations are very clear about what aspects of the behavior at the hotel were concerning to them. The unprofessional conduct in referring to a high level position, her dropping names, her refusing to leave the hotel when asked, her misuse of state resources by requiring her subordinate employees to help her at this at the hotel. I'd also point your honors to
I have a question, Ms. Passy. If this court were to determine that the plaintiff did establish a prima facie case, is there an alternative ground on which to affirm the district court on the whistleblower claim?
Well, certainly, Your Honor, there's no evidence of pretext in this case. Of course, are two, you know, prongs for that, or is there a similarly situated person? There's no evidence, and kind of hard to imagine there would be someone similarly situated in this circumstance. So then, of course, we're looking at if there's any reason that if appellant has shown that the employer's reason are unworthy of belief. They have not provided any, pointed to any evidence here that would show anything other than the DNR is very concerned that they have a high-level employee who is engaged in behavior that's causing federal law enforcement officers to report her conduct sua sponse without any prompting by the DNR. It's hard to think of a scenario where the DNR wouldn't be concerned that it's, about the conduct and the professionalism of an employer, an employee who goes out in the hallway without any clothes on. This is not, a line employee. This is the person who's in charge of the region, of supervising people and professionally representing the DNR. So we would certainly say there's no evidence of pretext, Your Honor. Also, as noted in our brief, I'll just briefly discuss the DNR's position is that she did not engage in statutorily protected conduct. Again, there's under Kratzer, the standard is whether the facts, if reported as true, constitute a violation of the law. Certainly, she reported facts that she believed that there may have been illegal activity going on. But the facts that she reported, if true, do not constitute a violation of the law under Kratzer. Moving on briefly to the Maltreatment of Minors Act claim, appellant is not a mandated reporter under any reading of the statute. This court need not decide the bounds of the statute here because she does not need it under any reading of the statute.
Ms. Pasty, can I just ask you a question with regard to that? If we were to disagree with you on whether she is a mandated reporter, would you agree that the rebuttable presumption set forth in the statute would somewhat automatically mean there was a court error because of the discharge timing?
2 points on that, Your Honor. First, we wouldn't agree. The rebuttable presumption isn't in the statute. Plaintiff finds that from the South Cross Commerce case, which was applying a common law rebuttable presumption. I haven't seen any cases where this court has applied that to a statutory rebuttable presumption. Regardless, the Ziegler case involved the same claim at issue in this case. And Ziegler, there was a rebuttable presumption at play in that case. The court nonetheless looked at the causal connection. So that's 1 point, Your Honor. But two, even if the court would agree that she is a mandated reporter, the issue of sovereign immunity would still bar such a claim against the DNR. As to sovereign immunity, that's a pure legal question that was raised by the district court, though raised to the district court, although not determined by the district court.
Would you agree that sovereign immunity is essentially a threshold question that we should consider first before considering the merits of the second claim?
It is certainly a threshold question. I believe, the district court properly, there's two threshold questions, right? Is she a mandated reporter is one threshold question. Another threshold question is, does the statute even apply to the DNR? So either way, I think the court could easily affirm without reaching the merits of the Maltreatment of Minors Act claim. I think either is appropriate for this court to follow. As to the sovereign immunity claim, the standard, of course, under 645.27 is whether or not it's clear and unmistakable that the legislature intended to subject the DNR to liability. We know from the case law interpreting or applying sovereign immunity that it's a really hard standard to meet. You have to really clearly say it applies to the state. Nichols involved, which is the case on point from the Supreme Court in 2015, involves broad language, organization of any kind, doing business in the state. A plaintiff in that case was arguing that meant the state. Certainly under a normal reading, it would be the state is an organization of any kind, but the court held that kind of broad language is not what we're talking about when we're talking about sovereign immunity and intentionally waiving sovereign immunity.
Ms. Passy, I'd like to take you back to the whistleblower claim, just so I understand your argument with respect to the statute. Do you agree, or are you arguing that the reported violation of law that's the subject of the whistleblower claim has to be conduct by the employer?
No.
Okay. So if our facts were different, if we simply had Ms. Hansen calling the BIA, reporting her suspicions that there was a prostitution operation in that hotel and that there may be neglect or abuse of a child in the room next door, that would be protected conduct. I mean, her report of that, if made in good faith, would subject her to the protections of the Whistleblower Act. Is that correct?
If she reported, yes, I have seen prostitution going on in the next room, that would be.
So what where is the line crossed here between that scenario that you just said would subject her to the protections or bring her within the protections of the Whistleblower Act and the situation that the facts that exist here? Where did that line get crossed?
So I believe you're talking about the Kratzer analysis. Is that what Your Honor is asking about?
Well, I'm just wondering if you acknowledge that the Whistleblower Act could provide protection if all she had done is simply reported her concerns, called 911, which was the BIA authorities, that in and of itself would have been protected conduct. What is it about this particular case that takes it out of the protection?
Well, so Kratzer stands for the proposition. You look at the facts as reported. So if plaintiff had said, I witnessed prostitution going on in the room next door, I witnessed a murder going on, I witnessed child abuse, that is different than what was reported here. The facts as reported here are, I saw there's two guys who came to the room next door and they knocked on the door and I said something about the baby and they said, we don't want no baby, and they ran away. I mean, under Kratzer, we need to look at those facts. Assume those facts are true, does that constitute a violation of law? It may constitute a suspicion of a violation of the law, but it is not a violation of the law for two men to knock on the room, a hotel room next door, the same with the child abuse, what she reported as the child abuse allegations. I see that I'm out of time. I would just note that Hansen has provided no record evidence in support of any kind of motive and has pointed to no legal error on the part of the court, of the district court, who would ask that the court affirm the DNR.
It appears there are no further questions for you. Thank you, Ms. Passy. Mr. Tanik, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
I think Judge Bjorkman had a question she was kind of reserving for me for rebuttal. I don't know if she recalls it, but
why don't you proceed? I may have
okay.
had a question.
Okay, thank you. Where the trial court really erred here as a matter of fact and law is its analysis that the whistleblower claim could not proceed because it was that the judge couldn't imagine why the employer would want to fire Ms. Hansen because of her reporting. Judge Johnson commented on that. The trial court basically imparted into the whistleblower statute a reasonable employer requirement, which doesn't exist. Essentially, the trial court said, well, no reasonable employer in the view of the judge would fire someone for reporting these factors, the features, and therefore, because no reasonable employer would fire Ms. Hansen, the whistleblower claim is not actionable. Well, that really turns the statute on its head. Under that construction, essentially what that means is that the whistleblower statute only applies to illogical employers and not to logical employers or reasonable ones, because the judge is saying in order to have a whistleblower claim, you have to show that a reasonable employer would have fired this individual under these circumstances. Well, as we know, and I'm sure the court sees a lot of employment cases, employee terminations or other adverse actions aren't always logical, and they're not measured by their logic. They're measured by the evidence as to whether the whistleblower statute was complied with or not. And accepting the trial court's decision here would essentially mean that only illogical employers are subject to liability under the statute, and employers who act reasonably are not.
Tanik,
that doesn't make sense. Yes,
is there a requirement under the law that the alleged violation or suspected violation be a violation by the employer?
No.
So, I mean, let's imagine if an employee is driving on the road and sees another car that's weaving and bobbing, believes the driver is engaging in drunken driving and calls 911. Is that protected activity that could give rise to a whistleblower claim?
Yes, but the statute does not.
Let's assume the employee is on his or her own leisure time. There's no connection whatsoever between the suspected drunken driver and the employer. It's simply something that's occurring in other words, you know, at some point, I mean, if the suspected violation of law is so far removed from the employer, isn't it fair to wonder why the employer would ever have a retaliatory motive?
Well, one can wonder that. I don't think, but it doesn't make any difference under the statute. I think certainly, Your Honor, there could be some circumstances that are so attenuated and so remote from the workplace that the whistleblower statute might not apply. But the statute itself, according to its terms, does not have that requirement. The statute does not impose that it be a violation of law by the employer. And in this case, there was a work-related connection. Obviously, Ms. Hansen was there on a work-related mission, and she was interacting at work. So there was a work-related connection here. And the department, according to our position, took the action, in fact, because of its concern about its relationship with the tribe and the tribal authorities and the ongoing relationship that the DNR had with the tribe. So this case is imbued with work-related concerns here, and Ms. Hansen did raise those work-related concerns in connection with her whistleblowing claim. Furthermore, the Mandatory Reporting Act is applicable here. She was covered by the statute. There's two prongs to that statute. One is for people engaged in law enforcement, and while she wasn't a law enforcement officer, her job duties, including safety in the Northeast region of the DNR, and she supervised the chief law enforcement officer in that area. Furthermore, the statute covers people who are engaged in childcare, and Ms. Hansen did do childcare work for the Catholic and Lutheran Church. She was a chaperone. She did programs for youth. She did training on child care and appropriate precautions for children. So she's covered under the Mandatory Reporting Act. And under the Mandatory Reporting Act, as I already mentioned, as Judge Sleeter commented on, the statute by its term, 625.5564AC, creates a statutory rebuttable presumption that if an employee is terminated, or if adverse action is taken against an employee within 90 days of a report, there's a rebuttable presumption that it's retaliatory and violative of the statute. That rebuttable presumption creates an immutable fact issue here that cannot be resolved in summary judgment. And indeed, one of the cases that I cited, the Southview versus Topi case, is right on point, saying that a rebuttable presumption under the statute within that 90-day period creates a fact issue that precludes summary judgment. In this case, she was fired 6 weeks, well within the 90-day period after she made the report.
Mr. Tanik, with respect to the issue of sovereign immunity, which you haven't touched on yet, isn't this statute essentially just like the statute in Nichols with respect to the issue of sovereign immunity? How is it any different?
Well, Your Honor, the statute here does contain some specific references to organizations or individuals who could be liable under the statute. And they include hospitals and other institutions, law enforcement, people in law enforcement. As I indicated, Ms. Hansen's duties included law enforcement. She wasn't a licensed law enforcement officer, but her job duties described her as having a significant objective of maintaining safety within the DNR district, the region that she oversaw. She also supervised a law enforcement official within her district.
Okay, but I'm looking at the language in subdivision 4A, paren A and paren, which retaliation prohibited. And it says, an employer of any person required to make reports under subdivision 3 shall not retaliate. I mean, in Nichols, similar language just about employers generally was held not to be sufficient consent by the legislature to allow the state to be sued. It seems like the language in subdivision 4AA is there's nothing more in that statute than was in the statute in Nichols that would cause us to believe that the state had waived its sovereign immunity with respect to the Mandatory Reporting Act.
Well, first of all, the state obviously was her employer. And there's a number of statutes that provide for liability upon a state without expressly naming the state. The General Tort Claims Act provides that the state is liable to as if a private party would be liable. So under the General Tort Claims Act, the state would be liable here. The Minnesota Human Rights Act is another example where the state is not explicitly named in the statute. The statute doesn't refer to the state at all. It refers to employers. So there are statutes in which employers may be held liable for statutory violations. In this case, the DNR was her employer. She was engaged in law enforcement or childcare, so she comes within the ambit of the statute, which would invoke the rebuttable presumption we maintain.
Well, your time has expired, and it appears there's no further questions. So The court will take the case under advisement. The case is submitted. The court will issue its written opinion within 90 days. Thank you to both counsel for your arguments. We will be in a brief recess until the next case, which is scheduled for 10 minutes after 11.